You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In much of the developed world, including the U.S. and Canada, life expectancy has risen dramatically over the last few generations. Now, over half of all babies born here will live more than 100 years. That's great news in some regards, but it's a pretty worrisome statistic for people who focus on pension systems and retirement issues. Social Security was never intended to pay out for 40 years, and many of us are not saving enough in our 401ks or IRAs to cover that much time. So, what do we do? Well, we can't just ignore the issue, that's for starters. And even if you aren't actually saving enough for retirement now, it's still probably better to know what you need to do to get there, or have a sense of what your actual financial picture will mean for your ability to stop working at a certain point, or if you'll need to keep going long into your 70s or even your 80s. Today on the show, we're going to talk about retirement and look at how individuals, government, even private employers are thinking about these things. And we'll be fielding questions about your own personal retirement needs. I'm joined today by John Pelletier, director of Champlain College's Center for Financial Literacy, and Liz Scharf, a financial coach for Capstone Community Action, a nonprofit working in Washington, Orange, and Lamoille counties to help people gain stability and financial independence. Liz and John, welcome back to both of you. Nice to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, thanks.
Okay, so first of all, the idea that everybody might live to 100 is both lovely and terrifying at the same time. And, you know, we could go really deep into that idea, but let's stick to the idea about how that affects our retirement savings and our structures in this country for the public system that we've created. We know that there's a strain on Social Security, and part of that strain is people living longer than the program was ever intended for people to live after they stopped working. And of course, there's a strain on our own individual savings. Maybe, you know, people who started 30 or 40 years ago didn't think that they were going to have 30 or 40 years after they stopped working to have to pay for. So, Liz, I'll ask both of you, but Liz, maybe you could start game that out for us a little bit. What are we working with here?
Well, you bring up a good point, is that people are living longer, and oftentimes people have the mindset of like, well, you know, my parents died early, I'm not going to live that long. A lot of the people that I work with who are low to moderate income often are thinking about what's happening today, not so much next year, let alone in 30 years. So the planning is being put off. And then they get to the age and it's suddenly, you know, if they're lucky, they have the average 1300 Social Security and nothing else saved. So it really is a problem. And what I do is try to work with people to really help them think about saving now, saving early. And even if they haven't started saving, start saving today.
Okay, so save now, save early, save. Now, Liz, I know that for many of us, though, the question of saving is not one of desire. It's one of trying to balance how many pennies can you spare from your paycheck to go into savings, which, yeah, I mean, we've all gotten the message. We know we're supposed to save. But if you're trying to pay for childcare and gas and maybe education and all these other things that are our needs right now, and if you bounce a check, you're in trouble, versus that long ahead, maybe retirement, maybe if we're lucky. How do you advise people who don't have a lot to spare on how to make that balance?
Yeah, so I see people that you're referring to with those very similar financial issues every single day.
And I would add, it's not people who are sort of at the lowest end of the income level. I mean, that's a truth for so many of us.
Exactly. In fact, I work with a lot of people who are not just low and moderate, but who make very good money, who are still struggling to get all their bills paid, save for college, and save for retirement at the same time. I will say that, you know, anything that you can save, and I use an example of one of the clients that I work with, who's a single mom who does receive some housing subsidy, has received daycare subsidy, and works at a big box store. And when I talked to her about retirement and really encouraged her to set aside 5%, she did it. And not only did she save at the end of the year, she saved, I think, close to $1,200 and received what was called the Savers Credit, which is a IRS tax credit for low-income savers. So it can be done, and it's just – it really is a matter of making sure you get, you know, you understand your budget, understand what your take-home pay is going to be after, you know, after you give to retirement. And it's hard. I completely agree with that. And, you know, anything, even if it's 1%, 2%, setting something aside and starting early is really the key.
John, you agree?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's the hard part is to catch up once you're 50, 55. I mean, an example that I think helps people get their head around this is if you assume that you're 20 years old and you want to be a millionaire, you want $1 million saved, you have to save less than $300 a month. So
when you're in your 20s.
When you're in your 20s, yeah. Assuming a 7% return, which isn't an outrageous return expectation over that many years. The problem is at age 55, right, you have to save $8,000 a month. And so the longer you wait, and it's compounding. And the best example, you know, when I talk to students about thinking about compounding, if you're 18 years old and your grandfather passes away and leaves $10,000 in his will, and he says, please, you know, Johnny or Janie, don't spend this money, put it into the S&P 500 index fund from Vanguard and leave it alone until you're age 68. And so you're 18, you wait until you're 68. If you can double your money every decade, which is a little over 7% a year, that $10,000 at age 18 becomes $320,000 at age 68. And we don't do a very good job in teaching math in this state about how compounding works.
Yeah, maybe you can give us that sort of remedial compounding education.
Yeah, I mean, one is you know, you think about the rule of 72 and you divide a number into 72 and it says, you know, how long will it take me to double my money? So if you're getting a 1% return and you're not even getting that today in your savings account, it would take you like 72 years to double your money. So you need to take a little bit more risk. You need to you know, basically, you know, when you're younger and even when you're older, have some level of equities. Unfortunately, people are, given the last two market crashes we've had, they're a little afraid of equities. And so compounding, it's really, really important. I'll give you the best example of compounding. What would you rather have today? $500,000 cold cash, I'll give it to you right now, or a penny that doubles every day for 30 days. And you know, when I raise that in a classroom, you know, a lot of people assume there's got to be a gimmick, so they go with the penny, but they don't understand why, and others will want the $500,000. But a penny doubled every day for 30 days is over $5 million. And so doubling your money, and that's not a fair example, because if you can double your money in a decade, 30 doublings is 300 years. So it's not a fair.
Yeah,
it's not fair.
It's, you're not actually going to retire off that one penny.
No, you're not. But we've got to do a better job of getting folks to understand the importance of saving when they're younger.
I'm going to take John's $500,000 and I'm going to invest it into whatever account he has for that penny that's doubling every day. And then I'm going to be in great shape and I can fund everybody else's retirement. David is calling in from Wilmington. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
My question is, how is a person who works minimum wage all their life supposed to save for retirement when they can't even meet the needs they have in the present?
David, it's a good question. And Liz, you were giving us an example of that just a minute ago, of the client you've worked with. And maybe you can offer some concrete ideas of how you do that, especially how you get over that, maybe that psychological hump of thinking, there is no way I can do this. How do you do it? I mean, just practically speaking.
Yeah, I mean, and the caller, David, is right. It's really hard on a minimum wage salary to save for retirement. One of the things that we do at the community action agencies is file taxes through the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. And that's a time when many low-income people get the earned income tax credit, which can be in the thousands of dollars, especially if they've got some kids. And we encourage people at that time to set even if it's just a couple hundred dollars into either we have something through the U.S. Treasury called the MyRA, which granted isn't a great interest rate, but it's a safe and secure place to deposit small amounts of money towards retirement. Or if they have the option of putting money into a low-cost investment account, we encourage people to set some of their tax returns back, because it is hard, especially if you don't have a workplace retirement account and you're working a minimum wage job, to figure out how am I going to get my, you know, few dollars into a retirement account. So during tax time is really a time that we encourage people to set aside some money for retirement. And also just looking at, even if it's 1%, you know, if you bring home $300 a week, 1% is $3, you know, and can you afford $3, you know, and it's not going to make you rich, but it's a start. And making savings automatic and putting aside even that small amount goes a long way psychologically as well to knowing that you've put some money aside.
If at tax time you're getting something back and you've been holding off on, let's say, like fixing your car or fixing something on your house, and you have the choice between making that fix that's necessary or saving for retirement, putting that money away, obviously, everybody's situation is going to vary, but when we're talking about the importance of retirement savings, John, is it really something that you should consider actually putting that money into retirement? I mean, is retirement saving that important?
I think it is. It depends. I mean, if you don't fix your car and you can't go to work and you lose your job, then I think you fix your car. But it really isn't important, because when you look at the statistics, when you retire, what you're going to want is to be able to replace your income to the tune of somewhere between 65% and 70%. And some people would tell you 80% of your income. And the lower income people, the one good thing about Social Security is that it is intended to replace a lot more of your income if you're not making a lot of income than if you are. So an example would be, if you're in the lower earning category, it might work out to be 57% of your income is replaced. So if you are poor, you frankly have to save a lot less than, say, very, very rich people to get to that similar income replacement ratio, whereas for a high earner, it's probably about a third. So it's there's a – you know, it was really meant – to help the most impoverished, and it still does that pretty well. But I don't think you want to be that 23% of Vermont that are relying on Social Security for 90% or more of their retirement income.
But why not? I mean, Liz, I think there's that sort of sneaking feeling that many of us have that, well, it's all going to come out in the end. And really, the social safety net is there to catch me. So if I haven't saved enough, I'm going to be okay, because at least I have Social Security and there will be things in place that'll, you know, make it fine for me in retirement. Is that not true?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. Currently, I mean, I would say that a lot of the low income people who come to do taxes, for example, who have very low incomes and who really only have Social Security and maybe are filing their taxes for the renter's rebate, for example, are getting subsidized rent. They have the food shelf available to them. They have, you know, other fuel assistance, for example. But, you know, some of that's on the chopping block right now. And any money that people have for retirement really is sort of a win for us, because it is less of a burden on the taxpayers, because we don't have to provide as much social services to make up for what Social Security is not. It's just not enough to cover all the monthly living expenses.
Let's go to Sue in Essex. Hi, Sue. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a question, and I was wondering that when you work for a company that has a 401k plan and you leave it, is it a wise move to leave that money in the 401k plan, even if it's doing quite well and the fees are relatively low?
Or what, Sue? Is the other option you're thinking of?
Or to take it out and to put it in another investment firm, maybe something that you have a little more, that would be more of a fiduciary type of investment firm.
Sue, thanks for the question. And, you know, it's going to depend as well, John, on whether you're going to another company that has another employer-sponsored plan, or if you're leaving that work and thinking you're going to pull this out and do something with it on your own. But to Sue's question, what's the right approach?
I think it really depends. It depends on the facts and circumstances. If you've left and you're in retirement and you're very comfortable with the plan and you think the expenses are low, and that's the key thing, understanding. You really want to understand not only the plan participant expenses, but the expenses that are embedded in the mutual fund itself, because there's sometimes two layers of fees, right? There's the fee to be part of the 401k plan, and then there's the fee to make that underlying investments.
The fee that you pay to be in it, but then the money that they might take out from what you're putting in to actually administer the plan.
Yeah, exactly. So they're per participant fees sometimes the companies bear all of them. Sometimes they make you bear them directly in your account. And on top of that, say you're in a mutual fund and it's charging you 1% a year of your money. And so when you add it all up, you really want to understand your fees. But if you have a very good plan with low fees and really good product that are low products, the one thing you do get out of a 401k plan is you actually have a plan fiduciary whose job it is to make sure they actually have to keep an eye on all those investment options and make sure that they're good. And so you could hire a financial advisor and move the money over, but you probably don't want to move the money over if you're going to pay a lot more for similar products. So it's really, I'd really dig in and understand the fees and are you getting value from doing that rollover? Studies have shown that, like, I hate to say this, but doing nothing with your money really works, just leaving it alone. That the more you move it around.
Sometimes if you leave a company, don't they sort of, not archive exactly, but sort of leave that pile of money where it is and it doesn't, they're not really doing much for you if you've left it there. Is that not true?
Well, 401k is self-directed, so you have to make the choices and make the changes yourself. So it's a self-directed plan. Usually what ends up happening is if the account's very small, the other problem you have, which I worry a lot about, is it's a small amount of money, say $5,000 or $10,000, you leave and the company says, you know, I'm not going to spend a bunch of money on your little tiny plan. Where would you like me to send the check, or would you like me to direct deposit it into your new employer's 401k, or would you like to put it into an IRA rollover? To go back to that story, the younger you are, the more likely you are to have a job that's 3 years or less, the more likely you are when this happens to take the check for a down payment on an auto or to take a trip, and you think, how could $5,000 or $10,000 possibly be something I'd retire on? Going back again to my $10,000 turning into $320,000. So they make a tragic error, and they take the money. And when they take that money, they have to pay taxes on it, and they have to pay penalties because of an early withdrawal. Keeping your money in the 401k is certainly better than taking it out.
We're talking with financial coach Liz Scharf, who works for the nonprofit Capstone Community Action, and with John Pelletier, director of Champlain College's Center for Financial Literacy. Debbie says a few callers have asked how people earning very little are supposed to save for retirement, and the answer seems to be work harder, although I don't think that's the answer we've been getting from our guests necessarily. But Debbie goes on to say, if you're struggling to meet today's needs, there is no way you can meet tomorrow's. The problem is not the poor people. People have to be able to earn more to save. This is a wonderful example of how far a livable wage can actually go. And let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Hebron, New York. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Hello, can you go on?
Yeah, hi.
I'm calling in to actually make a positive comment about saving and
great,
thinking that you cannot afford to save. About 35 years ago, I had a medium-paying job, and I got hold of a stockbroker, or I should say he got hold of me, and said, look, you've got to put $2,000 away every so often. And as a matter of fact, you do it every year. And I said, I really can't afford to do it. He said, no, you really can. If you really look at it, you can afford to do it because you're going to need to retire on something. You can't live on Social Security. So I did this. And I did this for 35 years, and I had to give up smoking. I had to give up drinking. I had to give up, you know, lavish vacations that I thought I could take while all my friends, you know, went off to the Bahamas. I stayed at home. And I also lived in a fairly conservative house with not a very big mortgage. And I just retired 4 years ago with $1 million in the bank.
Nice.
And I couldn't be happier than a pig in you know what. And my comment is, you can save. You've just got to stop buying the four-wheelers. You got to stop buying a brand-new car every 4 or 5 years. You can do it. And if you do it over time and put a little bit of away, you're going to be successful in the end.
Well, Peter, congratulations on your retirement. That's great to hear, and great to hear a success story of somebody saying, look, you can do it. And so much of it is psychological. You know, no matter how much or how little you're putting away, it's that idea of sort of putting away against your future, which is really hard to do in the present. So I applaud your initiative in making that happen, and thanks for sharing it with us. We did get a note from Wolfgang in Charlotte who says, isn't all this talk about saving for retirement assuming that we'll have the same economic system based on growth 50 years from now, when many experts predict a radically different environment leading to the collapse of our civilization? I mean, that's a scary thought, but Liz Scharf, I guess the idea is that it's really difficult to understand what the economic picture is going to be when we retire if we're starting when we're in our 20s. And who knows about Social Security? Who knows what the economic picture is going to be like? It could be very different than what our needs or what we think our needs are right now.
It could. And I think what we really have to do is look at the past, look at the performance of the stock market since its inception, and have some faith. If we don't save, I mean, when you think about, you know, the end of the world, well, if the end of the world, we're all done for. So, you know, but if you don't save, and again, this isn't, as John had mentioned, this isn't saving 1% in the bank. It really is investing in the market, which, you know, historically, we're looking at over the course of maybe a 40 years of saving 6 to 8% return. And that's where the wealth gets built. And, you know, you just have to not plan for the worst and hope for the best. I will say, in response to the caller or the person who wrote in, we could look at the saving in terms of being really low income. I want people to remember that even saving something, say like $45 a month, if you're really low income, so let's say you file head of household, your income is $27,000, and you save $45 a month, you're eligible for a 50% retirement savers tax credit. So that's $250 right back at you. Getting a 50% return is pretty darn good on what you've contributed. So I just want people to think not so much about the bigger picture of, oh, I'm never going to save $1 million, because you know what? You may not. But if you can break it down and break it down into each paycheck and say, can I save $20 a paycheck? You know, what can I give up in order to put that money aside? And as John said, starting early. So all those young kids out there who have just graduated from college and you're getting your first job, if they offer retirement, take it and contribute at least what you're going to get for the match if your employer is giving a match. And if they don't offer a retirement account, open yourself an IRA at any one of these investment firms that offers low-fee index funds, target date funds, things that can get you started.
And you can look all that up online. You can find out what the fees are. You can find out what the return rate has been over the last 10 or 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah, you can look up the fund. It will sort of – it'll probably give you a little chart that says, you know, this is a high-risk fund, this is a low-risk fund, what the 10-year or 20-year rate of return has been. And if you're young, you know, I recommend doing about 70% stock at least, and then the rest bonds in terms of what you're going to get for investment.
In other words, be a little riskier when you're young, and then as you get older, you put more into bonds because you're nearing knowing that the time when you're going to retire and you want a little bit more.
You want to make
security.
Sure that you're not too risky when you're actually in retirement. But you always want to have, in my opinion, you want to have some in stock because you do need to see that growth. Because that's another problem is people are living longer and they don't want to outlive their funds. So they need to invest it a little bit more aggressively.
All right. We have some questions here about this balance again. And June says, can you say a word about the best balance of saving and paying off debt, like credit card debt, given its interest rate? So, John, that balance again.
Well, I think can you do both is really, you know, what really helps saving for retirement, and people save for retirement every day with mortgages and high credit card debt, with high credit card balances, is can you make it automatic? And automatic savings has been shown, and it makes kind of sense from a behavioral standpoint, that if you can make it automatic, that's the best way to save. And the way it's made automatic for most of us in the state, probably about 65% of it, is we can payroll deduct. It literally comes out of our check. And so it never gets into our banking account, and we get a tax write-off for it. And that's the best way to save. So I guess I would say, you know, it's not either or. You hear the same thing could be said. My son's going, or daughter, to college. Am I better off, borrowing against my 401k, or am I better off not putting money into my retirement plan and instead use it for college? I don't think you want to do that when you're in your 40s and 50s. I think you've got to have a plan. You have to stick to it and really treat that money as something you can't touch. And the real problem is the folks who don't have access to a payroll deducted plan.
So what should people who don't have access to a payroll deducted plan do? I know that, for a lot of people, there is an employer plan, but the state legislature actually passed a bill this year that will create a publicly administered plan for small businesses that don't have an employee-sponsored plan. And this will take a little while to set up, but basically it's going to be available to employers, at least initially, with fewer than 50 employees who don't offer a plan for their employees, and employers can sign up for the plan, and then employees will have the ability to opt out, which is another psychological thing. If you have to opt in, you may be more likely to not do it, whereas if you have to opt out, you know, you're less likely to opt out. So, Liz, is this a good thing, this state plan or the state idea for how to help people who don't have an employer-sponsored plan?
It is an excellent idea. I think it's really what we need in order to get the 45% that don't have access to an employer-sponsored plan. I mean, this is what gets people to save, and you know, making it automatic and contributing just directly out of your paycheck makes all the difference in terms of being able to save. And you know, in the meantime, what I do for recommending to folks, I have a couple things that I recommend to people, depending on, you know, the person with whom I'm working. If someone is really sort of afraid of investing and doesn't really understand it and doesn't have a lot to invest, I do suggest the MyRA, which is the U.S. Treasury-backed retirement saving program, which only earns what the Treasury earns. So it's not a wealth-building account, but it's an account that gets people started on saving. And you can deposit as little as a dollar from your paycheck as if it's a bank account. So you get a routing number and an account number, and you can take it with you from place to place. And then once it builds up to $15,000, the federal government moves it into to a private account. For those who want to earn more money, there are a lot of investment companies out there that have no minimums for IRAs in particular. So to get people started, you don't even have to have like an opening balance, but you can open an account, and you know the costs associated with them are fairly low. I do recommend places like Vanguard, for example, that have index funds. They're sort of the father of index funds, and those have very low expense rates. And you know, once you could get yourself built up in the MyRA and have a little chunk, you can add to a private company.
John Pelletier, before we let you and Liz go, and this is a topic we could certainly tackle every day and not probably answer all the questions, is the idea of a standard retirement age of 65 done for? I mean, are we just, is that just gone now?
I think it is. In fact, a report just came out this month from the World Economic Forum begging all developed nations to increase the age to 70, the retirement age. And you've got to remember, I mean, the expectation, say in the 1950s, a pretty good life expectancy might have been 85. So if you retired at 65, you were looking at 20 years. If the stats are right, that you might be able to live to 105 years, and 50% of people in 2007, you're talking about a 40-year retirement. That's a retirement almost as long as your work life. It mathematically, it doesn't work. You know, the longevity risk is a problematic. The odds of you outliving your wealth are pretty high. And so the goal should be to make sure that we minimize poverty in retirement.
Boy, it gives us, me, a lot to think about as we have this conversation, and certainly one that we can continue having in the future. John Pelletier is director of Champlain College's Center for Financial Literacy. Liz Scharf is a financial coach for Capstone Community Action. That's a nonprofit that works to help people gain stability and financial independence, and it operates in Washington, Orange, and Lamoille counties. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.